Okay, let's start. If anyone still needs any of the handouts, they're here at the front, so you can just pick them up. I changed the plan a little bit. So I'm going to do a discussion now, rather than a lecture. So we're going to have a discussion now, then at 10:30 we have a screening, and immediately afterwards I do the final lecture, and then there will be a little bit of time for discussion then as well. But I thought we hadn't really had a chance to talk about Schindler's List, the film, not about my crazy ideas about it, but about the film itself. You know, Pavel raised a few important questions yesterday. What do we actually think about the film on its own terms? And secondly, how do we check, can we check our own responses to the film to see whether they have anything to do with my wild speculations? Yeah, so we can use ourselves as a kind of audience study that Pavel suggested yesterday. We need to find out more what sense people actually make of the film. And since I gave you those tasks, when you got the screening of the film, I gave you a lot of questions. You know, I thought we might as well go through those and see what you are willing to say this early in the morning. At least you're here, so even if you don't say anything, you're already well ahead of half of the people who didn't make it here in the first place. So you're already ahead in the game. So, I mean, one of the questions on the handout was, what was your immediate, it's the same question always, sensual, emotional, intellectual response to the film, this time, and also on previous occasions, especially when you saw it for the first time. Is anyone willing to talk about that? Anyone, you know, about their initial response to Schindler's List? Any aspect of it? For example, it would be interesting... Well, that's actually a long time ago. Oh, God, it's a long time ago. But it would have been interesting, you know, if some of you would have been dragged to see the film, you know, in a school, by your school. That would have been interesting, for example. But, you know, any aspect of your first encounter with Schindler's List in the cinema or on television or whatever, or what you thought when you saw it when it was screened a while ago. Any responses? Anything? Someone must be willing to say something. Yeah, it's not like a difficult question. You just say, well, I saw it, and I felt such and such. Come on. You always say something. So you start. No. I can always rely on you. So what do you say?
I don't know. I thought it was
going to
be really boring, but I actually really
liked
it.
Yeah, so what does liking it mean? You know, it's like saying, I like the Holocaust, you know what I mean? Well, what does liking it mean?
I think they did a really good job of showing the events of what happened in the film.
You mean the events of the persecution of Jews, or the events of Schindler's life, or both?
Well, I didn't know much about Schindler before the film, so I can't really speak to that, because I don't know.
That's actually quite interesting, because the original script, because Steven Spielberg was meant to make the film right from the get-go. Sid Sheinberg, I said, bought the rights to the novel, the non-fiction novel, for Spielberg. And Spielberg didn't commit to the project properly because he never had a script that he liked. And I looked at the script that he then eventually said it's workable. And that script, interestingly, has none of those intertitles or superimposed titles which explain at such and such a date, such and such a thing happened. You know, the Jews were removed from their places where they lived into Krakow. They were removed within Krakow to the ghetto. On such and such a date, the ghetto was cleared. You know, all that broader history is not in the script. So when Spielberg finally committed to the script, it must have been him who actually, because we think Spielberg, yeah, he's a sentimentalist, he can tell stories about kids and about aliens, but we don't think about him as someone who actually is interested very seriously in history and telling the broad sweep of history. My analysis, I could not help but conclude that the emphasis on the broader history is due to Spielberg, not to the scriptwriter. The scriptwriter actually said explicitly he wanted to be it all from Schindler's perspective. The whole film should only show what Schindler saw. And Spielberg radically undermined that and said, no. I mean, he hasn't publicly spoken about it, but you can see it when you compare the script to the film, that Spielberg insisted that it was as much the story of the Jews and the political measures taken against them, the genocidal political measures taken against them, as it was about Schindler. And the film is actually very finely balanced in that respect, which makes it closer to the novel. Did anyone read the novel beforehand? The non-fiction novel Schindler's Ark or Schindler's List by Thomas Kinelli, you know? Okay, can we have any other responses to the film? Any responses? I'm going to pick on people. You. I'm just going to... Yes, you. Then I'm going to pick you here. Because she's looking down at me. Oh, no, please don't pick me. So I'm going to work out what's from you in consenting. So you.
I really liked it. First of all, on the surface, it was visually beautiful.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, so here's a Holocaust movie, and the response is, it's visually beautiful. No, I'm not making fun of you, but it is quite extraordinary, isn't it? Because we are very sensitive to talking about enjoying something and finding something beautiful when it's such a serious subject matter. And in actual fact, the other term we could say, it's suspenseful. Extraordinarily suspenseful, because suspense basically means that you expect a certain outcome and the film tells you it's extremely unlikely. Yeah, you hope, not you don't expect, you hope for a certain outcome, like, you know, certain people will be saved, but it's extremely unlikely. So you're on, you know, on the edge, always hoping against hope that they might make it. So we like not to use these terms, but you found it visually...
Yeah,
beautiful.
Yeah. Especially the part with the girl and her red coat.
Mm-hmm.
When you only see the red color, and at the end when the color returns after the
yeah. Yeah, there's several bits at the beginning. There's color at the very beginning when the candle is lit, and then the red girl. And
we're a little bit late for the screening, so I didn't see the.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
But in general, I thought it was great because there were some funny parts. It was great to me how it mixed like something so tragic and managed to have some like laughs from the audience sometimes.
Okay.
I think that was a good combination.
That's a very courageous statement those two made. You know, they say, I like the funny bits and I like the beautiful bits and I like the, you know, I enjoyed all that. That's a very courageous statement to make, which I think is good, yeah? Because that's of course what is typical of Spielberg's work in general. Spielberg puts you on an emotional roller coaster ride. You know, he can switch the emotional registers in his films very, very quickly, and he does it, and he's willing to go from one extreme to the other, and he does it in Schindler's List. Okay, now you.
Okay. So, first time I saw it, I didn't really finish watching it, because I refused to deliberately watch something that made me feel sad.
Mm-hmm.
But now that I've seen it, because of this course, with a bit of a distance, I liked it. But I made kind of the same observation as what Mr. Skopal said yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when he broke down, it seemed to me a bit Hollywood, too much Hollywood-likey. Like, he didn't do enough, and I was thinking, okay, that's a bit of a cliche. He must know that he did enough. So that's the only part that made me think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good, yeah. Good, thank you. Okay, over here. Let's work in concentric circles.
So I should say something about the movie.
Yeah. Your response to the movie. Not about the movie itself, your response to it.
Well, I could continue with the COVID idea, because for me it was also super cliche, but the thing about cliche is, you know, to to show the truth. So for me, the movie was super truthful and showing the things how possible it could be.
It was not so much the movie itself, it was the truth of the events behind it.
Exactly.
Yeah? Because, you know, that's very different. You know, because obviously the movie does all kinds of things to entertain us. Yeah? To put us through... Entertainment you could define as having fairly extreme sensual and emotional responses to something in a perfectly safe environment. And that's what basically entertainment is. Entertainment allows you to experience fairly intense sensual and emotional things, but you do it in a completely safe environment. Yeah, nothing can happen to you. But there's also this thing that you can, and that, I think that was your response. You know, ultimately, I had an entertainment experience. But there's also the way, maybe you said, that the experiences, the emotional experiences become too real in a sense. You know, they're not safe anymore. Or that I try to see beyond what the film is to the reality behind it. And in that context, perhaps it stops being safe. And then it's not entertainment anymore. Then you might just want to switch it off. Or, you know, respond to it almost like a lesson or something. It's not entertainment anymore. It's now shifting a different register. Okay, we had some, you know, very different responses here. Does anyone else voluntarily speak, or do I have to continue picking on people? Volunteers. Their responses to the film. We're not very good with this. I'm going to pick on you now.
Okay. Well, for me, the movie, it was okay. I liked it. And I think, actually, that the Schindler's Breakdown is the best part of the movie.
The best part of the movie?
Yeah.
Why do you say that?
It seemed genuine to me. You could actually see his remorse, because just one more life is... He really thought about the things, the money he spent that he could use. Mm-hmm. Just one more, always one more.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously it's genuine in the sense of the character as constructed by the film. It has absolutely nothing to do with the reality behind the film. Yeah, so, but it feels genuine to you in the context of how the character was constructed in the film. Whereas for other people it did not feel in line with what that character would do in the film. It seemed like a Hollywood exaggeration or an operatic exaggeration of that character. But obviously it has nothing to do at all with the character, with the person behind the film, but it felt genuine to you in terms of the way that the film told the story. I mean, obviously there's no right answer because it's your experience of the film. You know, so as long as you speak truthfully about that experience, you can't be right or wrong. Well, you always have to be right, because you're just describing what you experienced. Now, we don't have to broaden it out much more than this, because we have a few other questions to answer. But I might continue picking on people, if you don't volunteer. Yeah. So here's concentric circles. So you know you're up soon. Well, not the ones at the back there. They're safe, they're thinking... I can have another 10 minutes of, you know, just relaxing. Okay. So this is just a tiny little exercise. What it is about is just to think about, I could use myself as an example of a viewer, and I can reflect, I can observe, and I can reflect on my own responses. And I can try to understand what those responses actually mean, why I respond in certain ways. And if I were to talk to other people about their responses, it's not about, you know, no one has the correct response. Everyone has different responses. And if you look at a range of people and their responses, you might see some patterns. You know, I mean, one obvious pattern usually is that women and men really respond differently to things. Or different age groups respond really differently to things. So you begin to see kind of demographic patterns. But there might be other reasons, you know, for example, expectations shape responses, or the circumstances. You know, if you were to be shown a film in a school class, you know, your expectations would be that it must be boring. all your expectations. Well, at least it's not as boring as the normal lesson, you know. So, but it's different. The circumstances will determine your responses as well. And you can start doing little exercises like that and begin to understand how films engage people. Did anyone ask anyone else about their responses? That was question five. Did anyone actually ask their parents or other people about their responses to the film when it originally came out? Did anyone do that? Anyone? It was on the list, you know what I mean? It's not unreasonable for me to ask this. No one tried to understand. Yeah?
Because
thank you!
Because we watched it my family on DVD, like in, you know, 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So I asked them what they think about it, and they said that they know Holocaust mostly from documentary movies, so it's different to see it in feature film.
Did and they think it was better or worse or just
more,
different?
More engaging.
More engaging.
Yeah, and more, and it had more emotional responses than seeing it in a documentary way.
Yeah, yeah. Did they volunteer what their emotional response was?
Mostly really just, you know, distracting because those events are really sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but we heard that it's entirely possible to enjoy the film, you know, despite the sadness, especially since the film looks stunning. It absolutely looks stunning. It's beautifully shot. Secondly, it throws in, as you pointed out, quite a range of emotions. Yeah, so it's not just unmitigated terror and sadness. There's a range of emotions. So, but maybe the overarching response is probably some kind of horror and sadness. Okay, anyone else who talked to others about responses to the film? Anyone else? We had one volunteer, maybe we have another one. No? Okay. Now, let's move on to the questions about the film itself. How does Oskar Schindler change in the course of the story, and why? Anyone? How does Schindler change in the course of the story, and why does he change? Yeah?
Well, he starts as an opportunist. And,
yes.
Then he's willingly helping the Jews. So there's a shift from motivation of money to motivation to help people.
Yes, very good. Excellent analysis. Why does he change?
Because he's like inside, he can see the people are real, and that he can like feel the emotions of theirs.
Yeah. How does that happen? Is there a particular instance in the film where Schindler is made to realize what you just said? What do you make of that very curious scene where the one-armed man, where Itzhak Stern brings the one-armed man into Schindler's office and the one-armed man thanks Schindler for saving his life, and Schindler gets angry afterwards? First he's embarrassed, then he's angry. What do you make of that scene? Why?
Because he was really just using the Jews.
Yeah, that's a very good analysis. Schindler sees himself as an opportunist. You know, when he talks to his wife, he says, you know, all my life I've been trying to build up something, but there was always something missing. There was always something missing, and then, you know, and now I have it. And the wife thinks it's luck. And he says, no, it's war. Yeah, that's the most terrible thing you can say, that war is a good thing because you can finally, you know, be the capitalist that you wanted to be all along. So Chinta really has this image of himself as an opportunist. And it just, for the first time, he has the right opportunity because there's a war going on. And that's how he sees himself, as this successful war profiteer. And Itzhak Stern says, you're now a savior of human beings. And that completely changes the way he sees himself. Because that's not what he wants to be. Yeah? So he's embarrassed because he is shown that he already is saving human beings, when that's not how he sees himself at all. And Itzhak Stern has to, in a sense, teach him that that's what he already is, and that's what he should consciously become. Yeah? So Itzhak Stern is like the mentor. Itzhak Stern knows what the reality of Jewish life is. He's been in the special world of a Nazi-occupied Poland, you know, where the Nazis are basically on a genocidal campaign to erase Jewry, first as a social entity, as a cultural entity, and then as a physical entity, to really kill them all. And Itzhak Stern really knows he is in the special world, he knows all this. And he tries to tell Schindler not so much about the suffering of the Jews, but that Schindler is already saving them. And Schindler gradually has to accept that that's what he's doing. What do you make of the scene when the one-up man gets shot? And it's intercut with Schindler complaining about having lost a valuable worker. What do you make of that scene? That's a very curious scene. Because Schindler seems to say, you know, you're interfering with my production, that's why I'm angry. But we also know that Schindler knows that he saved that man's life for a while, and now that man has been killed. So his anger seems to be at that moment not just because he's lost a worker, and of course, you know, his opposite, the Nazi person that he talks to, says, look, you know, a one-armed metal worker? Really, Oscar? You know, is that really what you're complaining about? Surely you must admit he was useless. But Schindler's already committed to the idea that he's saving lives. That's why he's complaining. Although he says he's complaining because he lost a valuable worker.
Well,
so that's the lesson. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's what's happening. What's happening is that shift that Schindler is taught by Itzhak Stern that he is the savior of the Jews already. So the mentor teaches him what he already is and what he should consciously become, namely a savior of Jews. And that's basically, I think, the story of the first half of the film. That gradually, through Itzhak Stern's interventions, Schindler gets to know who he really is. Or what he could become, internally, spiritually, as it were. Because in fact, he already is a savior of Jews. He just has to rise, morally and spiritually, to what he already does. Which is unusual. Usually people, you know, we think that people have the right moral attitude before they do good. The film reverses that. Itzhak Stern makes sure that Schindler already does good and then teaches him about it, and then Schindler has to rise internally to what externally he's already doing. Okay. Why is there this emphasis in the film on Amon Göth, the guy who runs Plaza of Labor camp and is in charge of the clearing of the ghetto? Why does the film put so much emphasis on Amon Göth?
Well, I think because Amon could be a hero as well, but he didn't accept the invitation, basically.
Ooh. See, when you talk, they're very good analyses, you know. Why don't you talk more often? Okay, so if we say in the model of the hero's journey, the hero is the person who's altruistic. Yeah? So the person who's doing good for others, that's the hero. And usually you have to change a lot to get to that point. Because the starting point is a certain sort of innate, or whatever, selfishness. So Amon Göth gets the chance. When does he get the invitation?
When Schindler tells him on the balcony about the story of the emperor.
that the power is really to show that you can heal, but not to heal.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying really the next day, I think. But he doesn't accept it when he shoots the boy who didn't manage to kill the boy.
Yeah, that's a very interesting scene. So what the film does, it says, it doesn't say anyone is naturally innately good or bad. You know, like unlike many films, it wouldn't say, you know, that Schindler is basically a saint to begin with and he will do good. And it also doesn't say that Amon Goethe is a beast to begin with and he will do bad. The film emphasizes the possibility that at any moment, no matter what your history is, your background is, at any moment you have the choice to do good or not to do good. Even Amon Goethe has the choice. And he actually chooses for a while, you know, to be merciful. I pardon you. Then he looks at the mirror and looks at his hand and, nah, I won't. And then he shoots him. But it's not that he is innately or that he somehow is forced to be evil. He chooses it at that moment. So, I think that's very important in the film. The film parallels Amon Goethe. As soon as Amon Goethe appears, it parallels him with Schindler. How does it do it? You know, they're both shaving. So the film intercuts them looking in the mirror as if, you know, one is the mirror image of the other. Are there other instances in the film where the two are paralleled in dialogue, for example? Are there instances in the film where the two are put in parallel to each other?
Also on Schindler's birthday party, when he celebrates the birthday, and Amon, that's the point when he beats the girl.
Okay, yeah. So in relation to Helen Fisher, they're shown, but also, of course, the fact that Schindler kisses the Jewish girl, and of course Amon Goethe is infatuated with Helen Hirsch. So there's many parallels. But in dialogue, it's very striking. There's the scene when Schindler comes to Itzhak Stern and tries to explain Amon Goethe. He says, look, he's not a bad guy. He loves wine. He loves women. He loves, you know, but the circumstances are just, you know, there's a lot of pressure on him. But he's just like, we basically says he's just like me. He likes wine, women, and song. And then Itzhak Stern, yes, says, and killing. Yeah? And the funny thing is, the same happens in reverse. When Schindler is imprisoned and Amon Goethe tries to get him out, Amon Goethe says, look, you don't know to be around these Jewish girls. They have this magic. You know, they entice you. You can't resist it. Schindler's not a bad guy. He just loves wine, women, and song. Yeah? So both Amon Goethe says, basically, Schindler is like me, and Schindler says, Amon Goethe is like me. So in dialogue, the two are put in parallel. They're seen as mirror images of each other. But the point of that mirroring is not that they're the same, but to emphasize that at key moments, they make different decisions. And I think that's what the film tries to emphasize, that any person at any moment in their lives can choose to do the right thing or not, where the film defines the right thing as to be the thing that is altruistic and the wrong thing is the one that is selfish. And I think that's very powerful. It has nothing to do with reality. None of this has anything to do with the real Oskar Schindler. If you read both the Thomas Kennelly book and the Oskar Schindler biography, Schindler was basically friendly with Jews from his childhood onwards. You know, he was very predisposed to do the right thing by the Jews. He was not at all as extreme an opportunist as he is in the film. He hated Amon Goethe from the get-go, it seems. He never had any kind of, you know, oh, well, just the same, we could be drinking buddies and all, if it wasn't, you know, for all the pressure on poor Amon. This is all completely invented. But of course it's invented for dramatic purpose. The dramatic purpose is to show that Schindler changes. Yeah? The film would be very different if he already is a savior of Jews at the beginning of the film, and then it just shows how he continues doing that until the end. The film shows us that he changes under the mentorship of Itzhak Stern, and it also makes him parallel to Amon Goed to emphasize that no matter who you are and what situation you find yourself, you always make a choice at every single moment. Now, this is quite a strong point, because when Schindler finds out that the Plaza of Labor camp will be dissolved and they're all going to go to Auschwitz, to an extermination camp, what is Itzhak Stern's response? Can you remember? So basically, Schindler knows everyone will go to the extermination camp. That's it. What is Itzhak Stern's response? Does Itzhak Stern say, "Oscar, you have to try harder to save us"? What is his response? Can you remember? They're sitting. You know, Oscar tries to make him drink with him all the time. And Itzhak Stern always refuses to drink. But that's the scene where Itzhak Stern says, "I think I'm going to have my drink now." Because basically what happens in that scene is that Itzhak Stern says, "It's okay, Oscar, you tried. It's over. There will be special treatment, and we know what it means." You know, that's this piece of dialogue where Oscar says, "Oh, I will protect you in Auschwitz. I will make sure that you get special treatment." And he doesn't realize he uses the term that the Nazis use as a euphemism for extermination. And, you know, so Oscar says, "Well, I will somehow protect you, but only you, Itzhak. Not me, I can't protect anyone else." And Itzhak says, yeah, special treatment, I know I will get it. Itzhak Stern accepts that they're all going to die. And he therefore absolves Oskar Schindler. He says, "Oskar, you've done enough. That's it." And that's an extraordinary moment in the film, that the very mentor of our hero says, "You've done enough." And basically, you failed. And I'm okay with that. You know, this is it. It's all over. And then the next scene we see, Schindler's packing all the money into his suitcases. Or Itzhak Stern says, "You've done enough. Take your money, go home. Don't feel guilty. You tried. Go home with your money." And that's an extraordinary moment, but because now the mentor says, "As far as I'm concerned, you're free. Yeah, I'm not going to guide you anymore. You're free, and you can go home. Enjoy your money. Enjoy the rest of your life. I and all the other Jews are going to die." And at that moment, Schindler has a change of mind. Do you see how important that is? It's at that moment that Schindler says, "No, I'm not going to go home. I'm using all my money to buy my Jews." Yeah, again, he has to make a decision. It's not that you automatically, once you decide to be good, you will do good forever. You always have to decide every single moment whether you do the altruistic thing or not. And even without pressure from your mentor, without guidance, the mentor says, "No, go away, go home, be selfish again for a while." Yeah. At that moment, Schindler on his own says, well, he doesn't say it, but we know it, he packs, we think he might leave, but he just packs his money to go to Amon Goed and buy his Jews. And of course, at that moment, the film emphasizes that that is an extraordinarily, you know, a biblically resonant thing that Schindler does. Because, you know, when Amon Goed is very surprised, you know, why do you do this? Who do you think you are, Moses? Yeah, it's both a very mythical moment, but it's also the moment where Schindler, completely out of his own freedom, decides to do the right thing. Although no one expects him anymore to do the right thing. So the film always emphasizes that, you know, it's not only a question of change, it's a question of in every single moment to have the freedom to do the right thing or the wrong thing. Because that's a very strong, you know, message from the film, if that's how you understand it. And Amon Goed gets the invitation to just once do the right thing, and he just declines it. Okay. So how does the film's ending balance the celebration of life and the recognition of mass slaughter? The last 10-15 minutes of the film. You know, a lot of people have accused the film and say, "Well, how can you make a film with a happy ending about the Holocaust? You know, isn't it terrible to make a film about, you know, the 1,200 people that were saved when 6 million died. But how does the film balance the recognition that 6 million died with the celebration of the fact that a few were saved? We already talked about the scene where Schindler breaks down, but what about the rest of the film? Or what happens before that breakdown? Does the film remind us of the fact that the 6 million died towards the end? Anyone?
I think it does. I think it's written.
Yeah. Can we give a little bit more? Okay. Let's start with Schindler's speech before he breaks down. They're all in one of those. He gathers everyone, including the guards, in a room, and he gives a speech. And that speech basically says, tomorrow you will be free, and you can look for your relatives, but you're unlikely to find them. Yeah, he says, you are the survivors, but virtually everyone you know will have been killed. And then he says, you know, let's have a minute of silence for those that are killed. So that's the first thing. The people who are saved are put in contrast to the much larger number that have been killed. Then we already said that Schindler's breakdown, as operatic as it may be, or unbelievable as it may be, is basically recognizing that there's so many more that could have been, should have been saved, and they weren't. The next step is, at some point there's a title about the 6 million killed, but are there other indications, reminders, of the magnitude of people who were killed in contrast to the few that were saved? Are there other reminders? Well, there's a sort of implicit reminder, isn't there, when the Soviet soldier arrives and says, I liberate you. And then they ask him, what do we do now? And he says, well, don't go east. They hate you there. Yeah? Also, there's no one left of your kind, as it were. Don't go east. Don't go west either. And of course, where they have to go is to the promised land. They can only go, and they go, you know, they go towards a village, but in actual fact, the way it cuts, the film cuts from them going over the hill, and they actually end up in the promised land, walking towards Schindler's grave. So the only place for the Jews is the promised land. Very Zionist ending. But there's a reminder there that basically they hate you here. Yeah, there's this. You're surrounded by death here. You know, so that's a reminder. You're this tiny minority surrounded by death and hatred. The other reminder is, you know, that title which says there are, you know, 3,000 Jews left in Poland today, and there are 5,000 descendants of the Schindler Jews in Israel. Yeah, of course you have to know how many that, you know, 20% of the Jewish of the Polish population or 15% were Jewish. Yeah, so you have to know that, and then you see, oh my God, there's only 3,000 Jews left in Poland today, meaning everyone else has been killed. Or got a chance to go to Israel. And then there's 5,000 descendants of the Schindler Jews. So that's another reminder that these few survivors are surrounded by the sea of death. And then there are, I think the very, very final reminder is when we see the path into Plaza of labor camp again. Do you remember what it is made of, the path into the main entrance? Yeah, Jewish tombstones. Yeah, so the last thing you see almost in the whole film are these tombstones. And they're significant in two ways. First of all, they signify death, but they're also the tombstones that were used as the entryway into Plaza of Labor camp, which stands for the whole genocidal campaign of the Nazis. So I think the film works very, very hard to always remind us of the lives that were saved against the backdrop of all the ones that were killed. So the last 15 minutes of the film are all about that. And it's in that context that Schindler says, I could have saved more. And it's in that context that the film's motto, is so important. He who saved life, one life saves the world entire. So that's what I tried to get at yesterday. Acknowledging that so many died doesn't mean that a single life is worth nothing. Quite on the contrary. Every single life is worth everything. No matter how many people die, every single life is worth absolutely everything. And I think that's what the film tries to do towards the end. It tries to balance those two perspectives. Anything else you want to say about the film? Any other observation? I mean, I can talk a little bit more about the funny thing is, what is really remarkable about the film is it actually focuses on something that Spielberg has been very good at singling out as the most powerful emotional bond and issue that you can, if you put it negatively, exploit, or that you can draw on. In E.T., don't forget that Schindler's List was meant to be the film that he was supposed to make immediately after E.T. In E.T., Spielberg, for the first time, I think, in his whole career, really concentrates on the primal bond between children and their parents. And as you may remember from E.T., the father is gone, the mother is completely distressed, because, you know, the father has run off with his secretary or whatever to Mexico. She's on her own, she has three kids, she has to work, she has to raise the three kids, and she has to deal with emotional trauma of divorce. And in that context, you know, the whole family is in complete distress. And it's in that context that this magical figure of E.T. comes to eventually heal the family. But at the heart of the whole film's relationships, apart from the E.T., Elliot relationship is basically Elliot and his mother. And I don't know whether you remember the scene, which is an extraordinarily multi-layered scene, when the mother for the first time sees E.T. You know, E.T. is dying, and since E.T. is connected with Elliot, Elliot is dying as well. And they're in the bathroom, and the mother comes in. Yeah, and the mother sees her son dying with this alien creature. And she grabs Elliot and takes him away. Yes, she tries to disrupt the bond between Elliot and E.T., but as a mother protecting her son. And then, of course, the whole film ends at the end when E.T. says, come, you know, and Elliot says, stay. And, of course, Elliot doesn't leave, but he returns, as it were, to his mother who now has a better understanding of her children, the whole family is healed. And, of course, E.T. himself, his trauma is that he was separated from what? The mothership. And he returns to the mothership at the end. So E.T. as a film is really centrally concerned with our primal bond to our mothers and how that any disruption, any disturbance in that bond creates incredible suffering. And it's that Spielberg from then on makes central to his career. Has anyone seen Color Purple? Anyone? No one has seen The Color Purple. Okay, well, that's the film that Spielberg, the first serious film that Spielberg makes after E.T., which starts with a teenage girl giving birth and the child that she gives birth to being ripped away from her, and she doesn't see that child until the very end of the film. She's reunited with the child at the very end of the film. That's the whole arc of the film. And what I'm trying to get at is that mother-child bond is central to Schindler's List. Can you give some examples? That apart from all the other emotional bonds that we have, that in Schindler's List, some of the most powerful scenes, I think, are actually about the mother-child bond. Can anyone name one of those scenes?
When the mom tries to go into the floor with her kid and the other lady, and the lady says there's no room for you, and so she leaves her kid there, but the kid still runs after her mom.
That's very powerful, isn't it? Because the mother has to decide, look, I'll leave you there because it will save your life. And then the child has to decide, yeah, but I want my mom. You know what I mean? It's an incredibly powerful scene. Any other scene?
When during the liquidation of Ghetto, there is the girl in red coat, and she's probably looking for her mother.
Yeah, yeah. It's very striking that you single it out, and there's something missing from the picture, yeah? Anything else?
Especially when they have the medical examination in the concentration camp already, and the mothers are happy that they are going to survive, but then they see their children being taken.
Oh, that's the most terrible scene at all. And that gives me shivers just thinking about it, because the Nazis put on this cheerful music, and the children all are gathered onto this truck. And the children think they're going on an exciting, adventure, some holiday or something, yeah? And they're all singing and waving and everything. And the mothers who've just survived the selection hear the music and see that truck driving with their children. And they initially don't know what to make of it. And then they realize these children, their children, will be driven to the gas chambers. But the children don't know that. The children think they're going on a holiday or something. And they're all waving and singing, they're very cheerful, the mothers run after them. It's a really extraordinary scene. Any other scene? Well, there's the scene when Schindler gets the women out of Auschwitz. And at the very last moment, the guards want to separate the children from the mothers. Yeah, so they're happy because they're now being freed. It's amazing, a miracle which really happened. They're gonna get out of Auschwitz. But at the very last moment, some guard rips the children away, and they would stay and be killed, and the mothers would only be allowed to go. And at that moment, magically Schindler appears, which didn't happen, and says, "Look, you know, how do you clean the inside of a shell? You need these tiny little fingers, so please, you know, let them go." So that's another moment where the film really emphasizes that. And I think that's something of the most powerful, because we talked about Spielberg putting people on roller coaster, emotional roller coaster rides. But the most powerful emotions, the most primal emotions, are to do with children and their mothers, both from the point of view of the children and of the mothers. And Spielberg, for the first time in his career, really, really explored in E.T. And the two films that he was considering immediately after making E.T., apart from another Indiana Jones sequel, were Color Purple, which is all of the film is structured, unlike the book, around the mother-child bond and the separation and reunion of mothers and children. And he does the same at the heart of Schindler's List, which is the film he was thinking about when he had just completed E.T. Of course, he didn't do it because he didn't find a satisfactory script. So that's something I think quite unusual, that he really goes to the most intense human bonds, the most primal human bonds that we can imagine, which is not between, you know, two lovers or whatever. It's between a mother and her children, or a child and his or her mother. And he really explores that. And he basically says that, you know, that the evil of the Nazi regime, it's not just the murder, it's in particular the ripping apart of that bond. And the miracle, as it were, of Schindler's deeds is that he was able to bring mothers and children back together, or to hold them back together, to hold them together. Okay, any other comments about the film? Anything else we haven't mentioned that you found worthy to talk about? Anything?
I don't know, it's just a little thing, but I find it interesting the name of the main evil character, Amon. It's Egyptish a little bit. As you mentioned, the Moses.
Yeah, yeah. So now the most amazing thing is, see, you wouldn't believe it if it wasn't true. You're absolutely right. As you know, the story of Moses, especially as told in The Prince of Egypt, is that he becomes the brother of the Egyptian ruler. And as I said, that in Schindler's List, unlike the novel that it is based upon, or the reality of the situation, Amon becomes a spiritual brother of Schindler. Yeah. So you're absolutely right that the Egyptian prince Amon and the adopted Egyptian prince, Oscar, they're really brothers. But it's true, the guy was called Amon. But what is even more amazing, what is the greatest German that ever lived? Not in the in the realm of culture. What's his name? What's the German Shakespeare? Anyone? Johann Wolfgang von
Goethe.
And you think, that just can't be true. Goethe is spelled G-O-E-T-H-E. And Amon Goethe is spelled G-O-E-T-H. And you think, this cannot be true. You know, I'm surprised that no one commented on it. Isn't that a cheap trick? Because the whole thing about the Germans always is, and the film mentions it, you know, when they're clearing the ghetto, one guy sits down and plays a classical piece of music, you know, German or Austrian music, and the other guy says, oh, is it Bach? No, it's such and such. You know, so the most sophisticated, artistic, literary country on the planet, which describes itself, Germans describe themselves as the country of thinkers and poets. Yeah, das Land der Dichter und Denker. And they're at the same time the most evil, you know, Nazis. Yeah, and this is this idea that the most sophisticated, literary, artistic, cultured nation on the planet is also the most evil nation on the planet. That is encapsulated in taking one letter away from Goethe to make it good. You would think that's the cheapest trick in the book, but the guy really was called Amon Goethe. And it is actually extraordinary. Sometimes, you know, if you had made it up, it would have been such a cheap trick. But it's real. Utterly amazing. I'm still amazed by that. You know, I... Anyone else? Any other observation? Anything else? Any other observation at all about the film? Anything? Anything at all? So, when Schindler goes back to his hometown, did any of you think, what's going on now? Yeah, so he goes home to his hometown, and it's written in the title as, you know, whatever it's called, Svitavi, what's it, in Czechoslovakia. Did any one of you think, I thought he was a German. I mean, I already talked about it, but did any of you at that moment think, well, there's something wrong here? Now, if he's a German, why is his hometown in Czechoslovakia? Did anyone notice that? Because the funny thing is, I've read dozens, if not hundreds, of reviews of the film. No one ever mentions that peculiar fact, that this German, you know, has a hometown in Czechoslovakia. I explained yesterday how that can be, because Czechoslovakia used to be part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Some people don't make such a strict distinction between Austrians and Germans. You know, so Oskar Schindler was born an Austrian, but yeah, that's good enough to call him a German. I also said that the German speakers in Czechoslovakia, many of them self-identified, even after the creation of the state of Czechoslovakia, as Germans or Austrians, they didn't want to belong. And they also, of course, in masses joined the Czech Nazi Party in order to bring about the destruction of this country that they found themselves in. But did anyone not, did you think for a moment that there's something wrong here? Shouldn't this hometown be, if he's a German, shouldn't this hometown be in Germany? No one...
Yeah, I did, and from my eye immediately, and I had to go to check it on Wikipedia and just like read about his life, because before I saw the film for the first time, I didn't know about him that much.
Mm-hmm.
So when I saw the ending of the movie that he was from Arabia, I immediately went to the internet and check about his life.
Yeah. But that's has anyone else, you know? Because as I said, the whole critical reception completely ignores that fact. And I told you that for Schindler himself in the 50s, he paralleled those two stories, the Germans in Eastern Europe with the Jews being destroyed by the Nazis. He paralleled the fate of those two groups. And I tried to explain that in the context of the 50s, that's not an obscene thing as it seems to be from today's point of view, because he wanted to elevate the suffering of the Jews by comparing it to the Germans. But it is extraordinary that none of the reviews commented on that. They all just accept that he's a German, you know, whatever that might mean. And I told you yesterday that when Pavel and I checked the Czechoslovak, the Czech reception of the film, we found references where they avoid the term German, they just say he's a Nazi. But it is an extraordinary thing that an important part of 20th century history is hinted at that moment, namely that a lot of Eastern Europe, for hundreds of years, had been populated by people who spoke German, and that ended in 1945 to 98% or so. That whole history ended as well. So and it's hinted at in the film, but it's completely, no one picks up on it in the discussions about it, which I find very strange. So if I ever get to write a book about all of this, the attempts to make a film of Schindler's life, I wanted to call it The Good German ? There already are books called The Good German, but I wanted to call it The Good German ? And the question mark refers both to good, what does goodness mean here, but also, what does German mean here? Yeah, so what does it mean to call him a German? So that was my, because it is extraordinary that this aspect just simply has vanished from the discussion about Schindler's life. There are some later instances of picking up on that. And one quite shocking one, when I first came across it, was using the biography of Oskar Schindler to talk about ethnic cleansing in post-war Central and Eastern Europe. Someone tried to make an argument that, when we talk about ethnic cleansing in Yugoslavia, we must not, because usually the argument, this is a scholar in Eastern European studies, and he said that ethnic cleansing is only used when the population transfer is seen to be somehow evil. But there are lots of population transfers which are seen as okay. Yeah, they're somehow justified. And this person said, look, this kind of judgment is really not up to us. We really need to describe the phenomenon and then see whether we want to judge it later. And he said that, of course, what the Israelis did, ironically, when they founded the State of Israel, was ethnic cleansing. And of course, what the what Eastern European countries did after the war, by getting rid of their German-speaking populations, was also ethnic cleansing. I mean, that was the only serious contribution to the debate I found in some obscure Eastern European studies journal, which used Schindler to reflect on what it might mean, what ethnic cleansing might mean, and where we find ethnic cleansing in contexts where no one talks about it in those terms, because it's somehow seen as okay. It was necessary, so we're not going to, say it's a bad thing to do. And he said we shouldn't really do that. So I don't want to, create some debate about, how terrible it was what, the Czech government did in the post-war period. But I just want to say there is a history there, and that history is important because it affected millions and millions of people. That history is hinted at in the film, and then it just vanishes. And with very few exceptions, the debate about the film and Oskar Schindler himself has not really addressed that issue at all. And of course, it's one of the most sensitive issues in post-war European history, because if you look at population transfers, they were enormous. From the Greek-Turkish conflict in the aftermath of the First World War, that's when there were massive population transfers. Turkish speakers were transferred out of what became Greece, and Greek speakers were transferred out, and there was millions and millions. And those population transfers became a tool of policy throughout Europe for the next few decades. Constantly, millions and millions of people were transferred from their homelands their ancestral lands, you know, lands where their families had lived for centuries. Constantly, millions of people were shifted around Europe. And the Nazis, of course, did that. They're the worst perpetrators, maybe followed by the Soviets. They transferred millions of people all over the shop. And then that culminated in the massive population transfers from 45 until 48 onwards, mainly to do with German speakers. But there were also other population groups which were transferred. So it's an absolutely central aspect of European history, but it tends to be forgotten, or it tends to be, it's so sensitive that it's very difficult to actually talk about it. Any case, now we have a break for half an hour, then we're going to watch some stuff, and then you get the final lecture.